Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest adventure, the latest reminiscences of life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rocket chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Leslie Ann, we're well into autumn now. I've been out collecting my conkers, and that's not a euphemism. I like to keep them around the house.
Just in case anybody was wondering, yeah.
But I do love this autumn weather, honestly. I think it's, it's been quite extraordinary, by the way, the last couple of days. I woke up in the middle of the night yesterday or last night or night before because the rain was battering down so hard on my Velux windows, it was like a drumbeat. And I thought somebody was coming up the road. You know, I thought the army had arrived. But anyway, I hope you've survived the inclement weather.
Did you see all that flooding in West London?
Unbelievable.
As well?
I couldn't believe it. But, you know, how do you get a foot of water in, you know, West London? It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Well, I tell you what it is. It's the drains.
Yeah,
you know, too much rubbish is going down into those drain grids.
Mm.
And they're not being cleaned out regularly enough. So they can't cope with that influx of water when there is a sudden downpour.
Yeah.
And so the streets flood. I don't know why they don't just come along and suck the drains out.
Well, I don't know why they don't do a lot of things these days. A lot of flooding in the country is down to the fact that we don't ditch fields anymore, you know, and we've taken all the hedges away that soak up water and all that kind of stuff. But look, that's for the ecologists to sort out. Meanwhile, we've got to deal with today problems. Now, Ms. Jones, I know you've been to a memorial service this week for an old Fleet Street colleague. And when I say that, I never talk about memorial services from old colleagues in a maudlin fashion. I always talk about them with joy and celebration because it really is a celebration of life, isn't it? Rather than, you know, a sort of depressive sort of bye-bye to our former colleague.
Oh, yes. I mean, a memorial service is not a funeral.
Yep.
It's a celebration of the life of the subject.
Mm.
They usually take place about 6 months after the person died.
Mm-hmm.
So that the family have a chance to grieve and get over their loss.
Yeah.
And then it's a reflection usually on the career of the person. It's usually someone illustrious who had a great career and there are lots of fabulous memories and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
And people gather together to celebrate that. In the case of yesterday's memorial, which was obviously Paul Callan, as you rightly said, a true Fleet Street legend.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, we all remember the Turnbull and Asser pinstripe suits, the bow ties, the extremely large lunches.
Yeah.
Somebody got up and detailed the kind of thing he would drink when he went to Elvino's.
Yeah.
So it would be a bottle of champagne. It would be several rounds of gin and tonics.
Mm.
It would be some fine claret or other. And then they would go to lunch, you know?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. I love Paul, honestly. Just to sort of paint a bit more of the background for our millions of listeners. I mean, Paul was, I think, the last of the Fleet Street dandies, you know what I mean? He was a gossip columnist for part of his career and all the best were. Ross Benson was, Nigel Dempster was, and he was in that collection of people. And, yeah, you know, I used to see Paul at the Epsom Derby, always in the champagne tent, of course. And I used to see him, I'd met him once in Los Angeles when he was over there doing something, but he couldn't remember what it was when I met him. And a great dandy, as you say, with the bow ties. I loved him as well because he was a complete social climber. He used to try and insinuate without actually saying it that he was an old Etonian. He liked women to believe that he was an Eton scholar. And number of times I've seen him pull that one are many, you believe me. But how was the wait yesterday after the service?
Well, I tell you before that, some funny stories were told, actually. Yeah. What a devil he was. His own son got up and gave an address, which he said many were the times that my father took me to first nights and social events and so on. And he would actually pass his own son off as his hot date and pretend that he was gay.
No.
And then there was another great story, Paul, in Los Angeles. He'd done a story with Doris Day, of all people.
Yeah.
And Doris Day was particularly taken with the photographs that were done of her for this interview. And she asked Paul Callan if she could buy them.
Mm.
And he said, no, you know, money couldn't change hands, but he would just give them to her.
Mm.
And she said, oh, goodness, what can I give you in return?
Mm.
And they're sitting in the Polo Lounge of the Beverly Hills Hotel,
right,
having breakfast at the time.
Mm.
So he said, you could give me a live rendition of Que Sera Sera, which she duly did, not expecting that Paul Callan would join in. And they had the whole of the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills as their audience.
Fantastic, honestly.
Good story.
Yeah, great story. And people like that just don't exist anymore in Fleet Street because we don't have the village anymore. We don't have the get-togethers and all that. Anyway, rest in peace, old Paul Callan.
Well, the point was made, by the way, that he personally didn't survive the Fleet Street exodus and that once it shipped out of the village where we all lived and worked, things were never the same for him. He didn't really recover from that. But there was lots of good gossip in the Humble Grape afterwards. Yeah, actually, I must tell you, John Blake was showing your Cinnamon Challenge around the bar on his mobile phone, yes.
Really? Good. Yeah, well, isn't that amazing? Cinnamon Challenge, eh? That's a few years ago. No, you're absolutely right. I think Paul ended up on the Express. I'd left the Express by then, but, I mean, he was a mirror stalwart, wasn't he, for 25, 30 years or something. Probably very well known to your dad, I would imagine.
Yeah, they crossed over. Yeah, he was at the Express, the Mirror. He was at the Mail for a while as well, I think.
Was he? Yeah. Well, he was a great sort of columnist, wasn't he, and great colourful writer, so... They have a gift to be able to sort of move around, but there we are. I've got a sadder story, actually, about a Fleet Street colleague who's gone. His name's Greg Miskew, and I read his obituary in the Daily Telegraph, and Greg was jailed at the end of his career for the phone hacking scandal. He appeared at the Old Bailey. He was charged with intercepting phone messages, which had become a crime, and he got sentenced to, let me think, 6 months in jail, but he only served 37 days because he'd come to an agreement beforehand to stay at home, you know, sort of house arrest with one of those bracelets on your...
Oh, he was electronically tagged, wasn't
he? Yeah, electronically tagged, yeah. But I knew Greg all his working life. Greg was a young reporter in Fleet Street at the Evening News, and I was working for the Birmingham Evening Mail in their London office. So, you know, we bumped into each other on a great number of occasions. Very, very handsome. But his history is so interesting. His parents were Ukrainian and fled from Ukraine before the First World War, you know, before Stalin moved in and all that kind of stuff. So he's brought up in Leeds, became a reporter. And then, you know, when... people in Poland started rebelling. Lech Walesa demanded freedom for Poland from the Soviet state.
Yep.
Greg actually got into a mail bag on a train in Vienna. He literally tied himself up in a mail bag in the goods wagon of a train in Vienna, which went into Warsaw in Poland and got into the country that way, and was the only reporter there who was able to file from inside Poland, which the Russian troops had then moved in on. An amazing story. He got jailed and it had to be like a big diplomatic incident to get him out. But I saw a picture of him in an obituary and I couldn't recognise him. He was, he put on so much weight. He's big.
He was bloated, wasn't he?
Yeah. And
I mean, the thing is, he was very frank about the fact that he was guilty. You remember that guy, Glenn Mulcair? He was the private investigator.
Yes,
wasn't
I do.
He?
Yes.
And Greg personally ordered 1,500 hacks from Glenn Mulcair.
Yes.
And I when I read that, I thought, where is Glenn Mulcair now?
Well, it was a very murky story about who was to blame and who took the blame. The one line I read in that paper explained everything about Fleet Street. It said that Greg Miskew was under crushing pressure every week to come up with a world-beating exclusive, because the News of the World at the time was the biggest-selling newspaper in the world, and, you know, the people who ran it wanted it to stay there. And that is a crushing pressure, you know, because if you don't get that, you know, blockbuster story, as you well know, every week, your star, you know, soon starts to wane, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it was the ethos of just get the story.
Yeah,
guess it, no matter what and no matter how.
Yeah.
And that does cause people to break the law on occasion. Yes. And he admitted that he broke the law on many occasions.
Yeah.
But, you know, he didn't try and reel himself back from his crimes, if you like.
Yes.
But he did pay for them very heavily. He was only 71 when he died.
Yeah, no, really sad, really. But anyway.
I'll tell you some other gossip that came up yesterday, actually, which is well worth repeating. They were talking about two memoirs coming up. Yeah. One by Paul Dacre. He used to be editor-in-chief of the Daily Mail.
And still chairman of the company, I think.
Yeah, he is. But he's written memoir anyway. Well, and the other by Calvin McKenzie, who's the last of the great well-known Fleet Street editors, I would say.
Or non-great, depending on which way you look at it.
The last famous one, let's say, or infamous. Anyway, yeah. It looks as though McKenzie will get a decent publishing deal because he will tell all those great stories about Tony Blair's affair with Rupert Murdoch's wife. Do you remember Wendy Deng?
Yeah, all that
subterfuge that was going on. And he does know the inside track. Yes. Whereas Paul Dacre is really struggling to get published because ultimately, who wants to read it?
Well, I totally agree. Paul Dacre's will be dull and circumspect and rather detailed in its political analysis and all that. Whereas McKenzie, you're absolutely right. I mean, he was the king of the tabloid editors, and he knows how to float a story which appeals to people. So, but I think it'd be strange for any publisher to want to publish McKenzie's stories because McKenzie is still regarded as the biggest known liar in this country because of Hillsborough.
Well, I mean, they won't be publishing it in Liverpool, will they?
Well, certainly not. Nobody will be buying it in Liverpool. They don't even sell The Sun in Liverpool. But, you know, he told the ultimate lie about the Liverpool fans. And he honestly, it's not just in Liverpool that they've never forgiven him for that. It's a lot across the football community. But anyway, there we are. I tell you who else has got a book out. And I read the first serialisation of it. I think it was in the Mail on Sunday. And it was absolutely fascinating. Is Billy Connolly. I mean, it's an astonishing book. I didn't realise the circumstances in which he was brought up in a Glasgow tenement, and he had abusive and bullying parents. He was sexually interfered with by members of his own family. And he came out of all that to be one of the most successful entertainers this country has ever produced. I don't know if you read the same piece as me, but it was breathtaking.
Well, it's very interesting. Two things. He's always talked about the deprivation and the dysfunction in his childhood.
Right.
That's always been part of his act, his stage act.
Right.
Second of all, virtually all entertainers have that void in their background, in their childhood. That deprivation, that dysfunction, the thing that drives them to seek attention on a massive scale because they lacked it as children. Mm. In the number of investigations I've done into rock stars over all the years, there are common traits.
Yeah.
There are reasons why they put themselves out there and seek love and affection from millions of people because they didn't get it from the very fundamental people who gave birth to them and brought them up.
Mm.
It's a common story. So it didn't surprise me at all. I mean, he's always made much of the Glasgow tenements and, the lengths people went to bestow a little bit of glamour. There were, he was talking once about mothers who bestowed the names of Hollywood film stars on their children just to bring a little bit of glamour into their lives. Yeah. And you would hear things screamed out of tenement windows, such as, Tyrone, come and get your tea.
Come and get your tea. Well, what sort of got me about it was he turned out to be quite normal after all the sort of deprivation. And by the way, I reckon he married Pamela Stevenson because she was a psychologist, not because she was a beautiful and famous actress.
Oh, well, actually, she was a sex therapist. She'd been an actress of her own accord, hadn't she?
Yeah.
Was she on Not the 9 o'clock
News? Yes, she was. She was on Not the 9 o'clock News with, what's his name, and Mr. Bean and Griff Rhys-Jones, I think.
Yeah, a long, long time ago. And I remember doing an interview with her once, and she said she used to spend most of her day when she was researching scripts on the tube, sitting on tube trains, travelling all over London, not going anywhere, but just sitting there incognito and listening to people's conversations because that was how she picked up on material to write about
for
the shows. But then she kind of quit that and she became a sex therapist in California.
Yeah.
She was coaching couples, who had issues in their love life and so on. I think it was probably more that that attracted him. But she was married to Nicholas Ball before Billy Connolly.
Oh, well, that's right. He was Hazel, wasn't he, in a TV series 1 year ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which Terry Venables co-wrote.
He did, yeah, that's right. Absolutely right. Yeah, he did. I see Tenable, Terry, by the way, who, of course...
Tenable, I quite like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But, of course, a long-standing friend of your family, still keeps in touch with your mum through your dad, of course, being the great football writer that he was, Ken Jones. I see that he's now made a complaint about, you know, Princess Di's interviewer. What's his name?
Martin Bashir, yes.
Martin Bashir, yeah, yeah. And I think you and I have mentioned this once or twice before on this podcast, but there was a programme done about Terry. It was a Panorama 1 hour long, and we all stayed there late into the night at the FA to find out what he said. And in the end, it was all baseless and it was all supposition. But Terry, I'd read recently, is now thinking about going back on it and saying, I want, you know, an apology and, you know, damages and all that kind of stuff. So Bashir's, you know, arm of sort of damage stretches a long way, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Did you see as well that the mother of the babes in the wood victims has met up with Princess Diana's brother?
Yeah.
This is to do with the missing clothes. There were bloodstained clothes, weren't there?
Yeah.
That Martin Bashir, for some reason, borrowed. Yeah. What was he going to do with them? But he never returned them to the family.
Yeah.
That mum has teamed up with Diana's brother,
yes.
Charles Spencer, to do goodness knows what. Perhaps they're going to bring a joint action or something.
Yeah, something like that. Just to put our millions of listeners in the picture, the Babes in the Wood murder was a mystery for years, wasn't it? Two little girls found dead in the woods down on the coast near Brighton. And years later, Bashir turns up and says, if you give me the children's clothes, I know people now who have advanced DNA tracking methods, we could probably get the killer. And he disappeared with those clothes, and they've never been seen again. And he claims he gave them to somebody to store at the BBC. The BBC say there's no record of receiving them. It's a right old mystery story, that, and one that's a bit painful to get into. Last week, Ms. Jones, we talked about another mutual colleague from Fleet Street, David Wigg, Wiggy, and he'd done a great interview with somebody, but I can't remember who it was.
And that was the son of Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees.
Oh, that's right. It was the son of Robin Gibb. And you said, oh, no, Wiggy's got a coterie of, you know, established rock stars who will only talk to him. No, behold, 2 days later, there he is again talking to Cliff Richard, who at the age of 80 is going out on tour again. And it's a lovely piece. He's, you know, Cliff Richard has spoken very openly about it. I'm taking no chances. I've been triple jabbed. And revealing how he's trying to consolidate his life, selling his properties abroad and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, you've got to take your hat off to old Cliff Richard still going like that, haven't you?
Well, yeah, and also Wiggy still going like
that. Yes.
I mean, why are we surprised, I suppose? These artists know that they know where they are with David Wigg, that they'll get a safe saccharine interview that advertises the tour and the product and won't stitch them up, because that's how he's always operated.
Mm.
Because he wants the next interview and the one after that.
Sure.
And if he writes anything controversial, they're not going to ask him again.
Yeah, no, so I totally agree.
He established his niche many decades ago. Yeah.
No, I totally agree. I'm just looking here at Cliff's schedule. UK Tour 2021. Thursday, October the 7th, Sheffield City Hall. Saturday, October the 9th, Birmingham Symphony Hall. Monday, October the 11th, Manchester Bridgewater Hall. Wednesday, October 13th, Glasgow Royal Concert Hall. I mean, people forget that when you come off stage, you've then got hours and hours and hours of, you know, winding down. And then the next day you're in the, you know, the van again up to Glasgow. It's a very, very punishing schedule for a man of 80.
Well, it is. It's punishing for anybody of any age, really. Yes. And they all come to hate touring in the end. But if you notice in Cliff's schedule, there is a day off in between every concert.
There is. There is.
So it's not just about, and he wouldn't travel in a van either.
Well,
he's
going
to be in a nice, comfortable limo or even in a plane or a helicopter.
His
travel will have been facilitated to the nth degree.
Oh,
and he will have a whole day off between shows and rehearsals and so on to just lie in bed. I mean, these people at this stage in the game are not going sightseeing.
No, that's absolutely true. Now, I read a dreadful piece just recently, Miss Jones, listen to this. A travel agent has vowed to boycott British Airways over unacceptable conditions on a £4,000 first-class flight. This guy's moaning about the state of the plane on a flight back from Mexico, first class from Mexico City to Heathrow. He said water dripped from the air conditioning, the food was dreadful, the seats were dirty and scuffed, and one of the backs of the seats was broken. It would not recline. And he's now asking for compensation from BA. I hate reading stories like that about BA. I love BA. I think I've told you before, it's always my favourite airline to fly over the Atlantic with. Were you a big BA fan?
Well, I was in the past, but I have to say the last time I flew BA, which admittedly was only London to Berlin in 2019, on a research trip, I was very disappointed, much the same as this guy recounts. You know, the food was terrible, the plane was dirty, the toilets especially. The little pull-down table hadn't been cleaned. There were coffee stains on it and this kind of thing. And I actually thought, this is now a budget airline, just the same as everybody else.
Yeah.
The days, I think the brand still speaks loudly to us. We think that if we fly British Airways, we're going to get something slightly better and more reliable than the other choices that are out there. But in fact, they've come down to the lowest common denominator as well.
Yeah, I it breaks my heart. You're probably not old enough, Miss Jones, to remember the famous advert when British Airways was privatised in the sort of late 80s under the Thatcher revolution.
But it, of course I'm old enough to remember that.
Yeah, the picture of Manhattan coming across the Atlantic and two guys sort of flying it. British Airways, the world's favourite airline. It was so glamorous, you know, to see, well, you know, buildings like the Twin Towers moving across the Atlantic to Britain and all that kind of stuff. And I used to love it. And my favourite moment was always going out to JFK if I was coming back from America. And the minute you went off the main drag up to JFK, British Airways was the only overseas airline which had its own terminal, literally a terminal for British Airways only. That's how much international North Atlantic traffic that they occupied. And I used to feel so proud going, you know, up that that expressway to the British Airways terminal with all the flags all over the place. And I hope it hasn't gone down. That was the famous time, by the way, when we came off the expressway heading towards the British Airways terminal. And I said to the driver of the yellow checker cab, excuse me, sir. Yeah, what do you want, buddy? I said, you haven't asked me where I'm going yet. Hey, buddy, when you leave New York, you ain't going nowhere. And he actually said that to me, you know, and I thought, well, that's great. But anyway.
Yeah, but do you know what? That was in the days when America was America.
Yes.
And that was in the days when we had things like an airline to be proud of.
Yes.
And a global profile to be proud of, which sadly we no longer have. We've got to stop kidding ourselves.
Well, look, you know, the position of your country in the world pecking order is going to change all the time. You know, we used to literally rule the world and all that. So I totally agree. It's something you've got to get used to. I'm having terrible trouble with a tooth, Leslie-Ann. I went to see my dentist about 6 months ago. And it was because I could feel that a filling, the only filling I've got left in my mouth, had cracked at the bottom, at the back of my lower jaw, okay? My
gum. That is weird, because your tongue keeps worrying it, doesn't it? Your tongue keeps going in search of the missing
bit. You can't eat a piece of toast. Horrible. You can't eat a piece of toast or anything because, you know, the minute a crumb of toast gets on it, ooh, it's like an electric shock. So I go off to see my dentist and he x-rays it and all that. He says, yeah, I know what we'll do it. We'll take that filling out and I'll chisel it down. We'll put your crown in. I said, okay, fine. And that was £1,000, okay? So,
oh my God,
it was 998 quid.
So I said, they're having a laugh, they see you coming, these dentists.
Well, look, the reason I'm telling you, I'm just going to tell you a story about another dentist, but anyway, point of my story is about a week later, it still hadn't settled down. You know, I've had lots of crowns before and implants and all that, and you know, for about a week, the gum can be bruised and you still feel it, but this was not getting any better. So after about 2 weeks, I rang up dentist and I said, you know, this hasn't worked. I think I might have been given the wrong crown or something. So I go back and look at it. No. I haven't done anything wrong. I wasn't accusing the dentist of doing anything wrong, but I thought, well, if you paid £1,000, it should be better. He said, I think what's happened here is that the nerves are going to have to come out because...
Oh, God.
Yeah, he said the tooth is so badly damaged. So it's the dreaded root canal.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Do you want me to come and hold your hand?
No, it'd be all right, thanks. I'm quite good in the dentist chair because I always
put you off.
That's right. I always demand the maximum amount of Novocaine into my gum so I can't feel anything for about 6 hours afterwards, you know what I mean?
And it's so always... Did someone go with you then?
Sorry?
Does somebody go with you?
No. I get it done. I just get a car there and back instead of driving because, you know, you can actually still be in a daze. The worst bit is if you decide to go for to a pub for a drink an hour afterwards and all of a sudden...
You don't want to do that.
No, because it goes in one side of your mouth, goes round your mouth and comes out the other side of your mouth. It's rather embarrassing. So
yeah, no, you need it intravenously. Years ago, I had to have a tooth out. Yeah. And it was quite a big deal. And I'm very, very squeamish about everything. Yeah. I sometimes wonder how I had three kids, you know.
You're right.
Just even having a flu jab or you know, vaccination. Of course, I run to the health center to get my vaccinations because it's the right thing to do.
Yes.
But it still terrifies me. Yeah. But I had this tooth out. My dad came to pick me up.
Right.
And I'd had, you know, quite a lot of Novocaine. So it was an injection in the arm as opposed to one in the gum.
Gum, right, okay.
It was a big deal so that I was out of it while the tooth was being taken out.
Yeah.
My dad came to the dentist, picked me up, drove me back to my house in Sevenoaks at the time I was living,
yeah,
put me in bed and left me there. And about 5 hours later, I came round and my pillow was just soaked in blood. I'm not joking.
God.
Just absolutely soaked. And I could have choked on my own blood and died.
But God.
My dad had no idea. God bless him. He just left me there and went home again.
God, that's terrible. But the reason I tell you this story is because you seem to think that's very funny, Miss Jones. Well, not sure.
It's classic dad, frankly, it was. He had no clue.
Yeah. But the reason I tell you this is I've read this story. A mother says she was forced to pull out 11 of her own rotting teeth because she cannot find an NHS dentist. Teaching assistant Danielle Watts started getting severe gum disease 2 years ago after her old practice shut in 2015. To wrap it all up, she's not able now to get another NHS dentist. That is a problem in this country. If you know, if you can't afford a private dentist, you've got a big problem.
Yeah, you really do, because when we were children, there were NHS dentists,
yes,
or you could go to a private dentist and have NHS treatment.
Yeah.
Certainly kids could, up to the age of 18. That's all gone now.
No, you can
go to your GP and get them to refer you to the dental department at your local hospital.
Yeah.
You're going to wait 6 months to be seen.
You are.
So I don't know what the answer to this is, because the vast majority of people cannot afford private dental
treatment. No, they can't.
I had a checkup the other day, £125 now.
I know. It's absolutely
just true. For a checkup. People on universal credit, retired people, and so on, can't afford that.
I totally agree. It's terrible. And the crushing quote here from this poor woman. There's a picture of her as well. I feel I've been fobbed off. I hate smiling in public. Well, I'm not surprised if you take
me. Poor woman.
Yeah. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. I'm the Portmeister, and of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, is with us today. Leslie, I want to tell you a story. As we are recording, it is the 20th anniversary of David Beckham striking the ball against Greece, which got us through to the World Cup in what you would have been, 2010 or something like that, okay? And it's one of the most famous...
That's only 11 years ago, Mike.
Okay, so 20 years ago. What am I talking about? Yeah, but the qualification happened the year before, so it must have been 2012, you're right. Was there a World Cup in 2012?
Yeah, but that's not 20 years ago either.
No,
20 years ago is 2001.
2001, so it was 2002. It must have been World Cup 2000. Hang on.
Do the math.
In the wrong direction to help David Beckham score his greatest goal in an England shirt 20 years ago. That's how small the margin of error was for the Greek goalkeeper Antonis Nikopalalidis when he was called upon to face the free kick 20 years ago. David Beckham scored it, bang, we went through, and the rest is history. But the reason I particularly remember this is because it happened at Old Trafford. Wembley was closed at the time, being rebuilt, and I was also at Old Trafford, and I witnessed this happen. I was sitting just behind Sven Göran Eriksson, who was the England manager at the time, and we were so jubilant, jumping up and down and celebrating. I remember Alvin Martin, a former England player, West Ham player, was sitting next to me, and Alvin went mad. You know, he was shrieking and crying. But anyway, that was that. I then decided, because I was doing a Sunday morning breakfast show in those days, that I needed David Beckham on the show the next day, which was impossible. David Beckham just didn't do interviews. You know what I mean? He did things which his agent told him to do, and which his personal manager told him to do, but he didn't do it. But anyway, I somehow managed to get a message to him through the FA, because I'd worked for the FA a few years earlier. And one of the great moments of my career was next morning, halfway through my show, and all of a sudden, you have a load of boxes on the screen in front of you for people to call and speak to you and all that kind of stuff. The words David Beckham on the line came up in this box. And can you imagine the frisson of excitement? Here is David Beckham, England captain, England hero, just got us through to another World Cup. And he's motoring back from Manchester down to their home, the one that was called Beckingham Palace, right? And he got my message and he'd stopped at a motorway service station, got out the car, leaning on the car, speaking in his mobile phone, talked to me for 20 minutes. It was, I mean, I didn't recover for days. I was in a state of shock and elation that, you know, David Beckham had bothered to stop and call me. He would always call us because they don't give their numbers out. But what a moment.
Did you manage to keep a straight face?
How do you mean?
Well, that squeaky voice. I could never take David Beckham seriously because of his girly little squeaky voice.
Oh, that's a terrible thing to say.
No, it's not. It's true.
A girly squeaky voice at all.
He does have a girly squeaky voice.
He's got a commanding voice. You know, he's...
No, he does not, Michael. He looks like a sex god. And the minute he opens his mouth, it all goes a bit limp, you know?
God, I can see yours.
Not for me, thanks. After you.
Oh, dear me. I mean, that's a terrible thing. I thought you were going to say, wow, that must have been a fantastic moment in your illustrious career, Mike, you know.
But no, I can hear that it was, and I respect that. But yeah. I have never been able to take him seriously. And he's never made a good pundit either. If you notice, he's not on very many kind of sports pundit programs.
He doesn't need to be honest. He owns a football
club. Not very bright. He's not very bright. And also, he's got a squeaky voice.
Oh, dear me. Well, I'm here. This is you know, talk about
where we tell the truth,
knocking down our idols. I don't know.
No, not at all. But just telling it as it is.
The point he made at the end, and this was an indication, a sign of how he picked up on the thing, the PR thing, very early on in his life. Towards the end, we were just about to finish. And I said, David, I mustn't keep you any longer. He actually had Posh and three of his four kids in the car. It was a silver Bentley. And they were just sitting there listening to him talk. It was a wonderful moment. But I said, well, David, you know, I mustn't keep you. You know, please send our love to Victoria and all that kind of stuff. And he said, yeah, just before I go, can I just say something, Mike? I said, yeah. And he said, I want to thank the fans. Without the fans, there would be no England football team. There would not be the power and the dynamism that we feel from their support. And it was like somebody had scripted it for him, you know what I mean?
Probably they had. Mm. This was all set up. You thought this was spontaneous, but it obviously wasn't. Meanwhile, this is a case of marital and parental neglect, because there is his wife and children sitting there inhaling fumes on a petrol forecourt while he's rambling away to you.
No, that wasn't a petrol forecourt. It was a motorway service station. He was parked over in the corner to keep away from the noise. But anyway, there you go.
I'm playing devil's advocate.
So the other great story I have about David Beckham, it's about Victoria, actually, Leslie-Ann, is that we were in Germany. It was the Germany World Cup. So that was 2006. I think I said 2010 earlier. 2010 was South Africa. It was 2006. And, you know, we went to all the England games and a lot of other games besides. And I remember being on the outer circle of one of the football stadia. I think it was Gelsenkirchen or somewhere like that. And all of a sudden, at one of the concessionaries, you know, selling sort of, is it Wurstbeist or something the Germans sell? Sausage or something like that?
Yeah, disgusting, Mark, isn't it? Really?
Well, I must admit, I don't like it much. People do. But sausage and chips it was. So there's a crowd of people gathering and people are starting to sort of get out their mobile phones and all that. And I thought, I wonder what's going on over there. So I go over and Victoria Beckham, Posh, as she was always known, Posh Spice then, more so then than now, she's only ordered some chips and sausage for two or three of her children. I can't remember how many she had with her. And has got this completely blank look on her face when the bloke selling the sausage and chips asked her for some money, because she just wasn't in the habit of carrying money. She wasn't in the habit of paying for anything, because, of course, the Beckhams, you know, have always lived a gilded life. So
what did she think they were going to feed her for nothing?
Well, I just don't think she kind of understood. She might have thought that, oh, well, this is a provision of food, it's free, or something like that. You know,
can't be that stupid. You really can't be that stupid.
Well, no. In fairness, sometimes inside ground, she might have thought, oh, well, I'm in a VIP area or something like that. You know what I mean? Everything's given to you free and all that.
Anyway, yeah, fair. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I leapt into the rescue, and you know, in broken German and broken English, I worked out that she owed this guy about 12 sort of US dollars, because I had US dollars with me, which I gave to the guy and said, you know, and rescued her from the crowd and brought her out. So I really was truly a hero. So
you're one of the few people on the planet who can honestly say you gave Victoria Beckham a sausage.
Now, come on, Leslie, and for goodness sake, honestly, there isn't a double entendre in the world that you can't just leap on, is there, eh?
That's your dirty mind, by
the way. Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, listen, I'll tell you what, we talked about Billy Connolly in the first part of this podcast. I, in the papers now at the moment, because nothing's happened for the last 18 months, everybody's advertising their new tour, aren't they? Everybody's out on the road. Everybody's going to be, you know, at Nebworth and all that kind of stuff. And I saw a big advert for Billy Idol. Now, I didn't even know Billy Idol was still going. I thought he'd sort of disappeared off the showbiz face of the earth about a decade ago.
Billy Idol will never disappear. I knew him when I was at school, actually. We used to stand together on David Bowie's doorstep in Beckenham. Really? I used to go around there after school in my little school uniform. And he used to be there. The guy who grew up to be Boy George was also there. Susie Sue was also there. Mm-hmm. I later knew him very well when I lived in Los Angeles. Oh. And my eldest daughter, Mia, and his little boy, Willem, used to have play dates together. So I used to see a lot of Billy. Yeah. Fantastic artist. He's brilliant live. Mm. I just love my favorite singles of his, White Wedding and Hot in the City. There is no finer dance tune in the summer months than Hot in the City. But he's a great guy. He sends himself up. He never took himself seriously. That curling lip of his, you know, he manages to control one side of his lip. I don't know how he does that.
He does. He really rolls that lip, doesn't he?
Yeah. Amazing. But he sort of kind of partly strips off on stage and he parades his muscles and all that. He's a send-up. He's very, very funny, and I love seeing him live.
Isn't one of his songs, In the Midnight Hour, I go more, more, more? Isn't that his song?
Yeah, that is one of Billy's, And when I worked at Chris's Records, he was on the label. So, my paths crossed with him a lot over the years.
Right. And also, the other one I remember was White Wedding, or something. They're the only words I know, but it was called White Wedding, wasn't it?
That's the one I just told you about,
What's that called?
White Wedding.
Oh, White Wedding, right, okay, yeah, fine, sorry. I wasn't listening, obviously.
Keep up, Mike.
Yeah, but no, the reason why it struck it, and you just said that you knew when you lived in Los Angeles, I met him once in the first-class lounge at LAX, Los Angeles Airport. And again, you're absolutely right, he was such a naturally nice guy. You know, he was dressed all in white, he had a long white overcoat on, even though it was Los Angeles, and he had, you know, white leather trousers on and white ruffly shirt and all that kind of stuff, and white hair, of course. His hair was bleached white, and it was remarkable just chatting to him for 10 minutes, you know, because obviously he's English, and I think he's English, isn't he?
Yeah, of course.
From Bromley, you said,
I remember doing an amazing interview with him years ago for You magazine. He survived this incredible motorbike crash.
Oh, yes.
It put him in traction for months on end. He was very lucky to survive that, actually.
Yeah.
You know, he was bigger picture. Billy always had his eye on the kind of, you know, the global scene.
Yes.
And he did very well for somebody with, you'd have to say, limited ability. I mean, he's got a distinctive voice. He's not much of a guitarist. He's one of those live performers who will stand there with a guitar around his neck, but he doesn't play it much.
That's right, Andrew Ridgeley.
But he makes up for it in other ways. I've always had a lot of time for Billy Idol.
I'm glad to see he's still around, because I thought he was a great entertainer. You know, I'm not sure if he's a great musician, but I think he's a great entertainer. Now then, there's a mischievous story going around in political circles that Boris Johnson appoints new Treasury ministers below Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who are substantially taller than the Chancellor. The Chancellor's only 5 foot six, and he's appointing all these tall people to try and make Rishi Sunak look smaller and to intimidate him in his own office by having very tall men, one of whom he's appointed is 6 foot 5 inches tall. Isn't that a ridiculous theory? I mean, has your attitude to the height of a man ever influenced your choice of friends or associates?
Absolutely not. This matters only because people bang on about it. There are many, many examples of short husbands and tall wives.
Yeah, of course there are.
Frankly, it boils down to how much money they've got. It really does. You remember Ronnie Corbett's wife was quite a lot taller. She towered over him.
Yes.
And Bernie Eccleston's wife. Jerry Hall is a lot taller than Rupert Murdoch.
Yes.
I went to the blessing of their marriage vows, which we staged at St. Bride's.
Oh, right.
And she wore flat silver shoes with her kind of pale blue wedding dress, and she looked ridiculous. But she did that as a, you know, a sort of homage to her new husband because she didn't want to tower over him.
Right.
And then we've got Ant McPartlin, who recently remarried, and his wife is taller than him. But so what, frankly? I really don't think it matters. I was married to somebody very, very tall.
Right.
And so my children tower over me.
Yeah.
But it's a source of great amusement in our family. I've also had very short boyfriends.
Oh, right.
It's all about the personality, isn't it? It's nothing to do with
Yeah, I'm sure you're absolutely right.
I'll tell you something else. Everybody's the same height lying down.
Oh, listen, Miss Jones, for goodness sake, we must get away from it, you know. Well, you know, the insinuation is it's all about rumpy-pumpy, you know what I mean?
And the whole of life is about rumpy-pumpy, Mike. You know, how do you expect the human race to survive unless there's a bit of rumpy-pumpy?
Yeah, goodness gracious me. The other guy was the guy who ran the very successful advertising agency, but then he lost power there because he was accused of having visited a lady of leisure in Belgravia or something like that.
Was this Boris Saatchi?
No, it wasn't Saatchi, actually. It was the other one. I forgot Martin somebody. But, he, you know, as usual with these guys, he left that company and then started another advertising agency, another massively successful one. I'm going to get on to a more serious subject because we do like to cover everything on life on Planet Porky. On this day in 1981, the hunger strike at the Maze prison in Belfast ended after 10 deaths. I have to tell you, that is one of the grimmest episodes in modern British history and certainly the grimmest story I ever covered. I was in Belfast for 6 months, all the way through those hunger strikes. My goodness me, what a terribly dark and black period it was. When yet another hunger striker died, the way you got to know about it was not through any official notification from the Northern Ireland office or Downing Street or even from the Republican side. It was the banging of bin lids on the pavements on the estates in Belfast, which were, you know, where the provincials had their power and all that kind of stuff, the Republican estates. You literally would be in the Europa Hotel. It would be 2 a.m. and all of a sudden you'd hear the banging and clattering starting and then getting louder and louder, and you knew another hunger striker had died.
Goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been a very challenging time in your career, I should think.
It was absolutely grim, honestly. The second hunger striker, it is alleged, I can't remember, it's Francis somebody. I can't remember now. But he wanted to give up and he asked for milk. OK, after a few days. It's a horrible way to die, by the way, to starve yourself to death. They have to put cages over your body so that the sheets don't touch
you. Oh, please. No, don't.
And all
too
this kind of
information.
It's too grim. And he wanted to give up after about 40 days. He asked for milk. He had a brother who was a priest, and the priest visited him in hospital, and he changed his mind back and decided to go back on hunger strike. And I'm not sure if it was the second, third or fourth, but it was one of them. And it was all horribly grim tales like that. We went to the funeral of one of them. And before the funeral, you were invited into the farmhouse. It was down in South Amar to view the body. And of course,
did you do it?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, what's to be gained? I mean, you can't write a descriptive passage about what you saw, can you? So,
no, the point is, it was all for show from the IRA. There was an armed IRA sort of, you know, paramilitary standing at each corner of the room with a rifle, fully loaded rifle, and, you know, the balaclava on their face. And you walked around the coffin from one side to the other. And, of course, as the person in the coffin had starved themselves to death, they were very small. I mean, they'd lost nearly all their body weight. And there was a card pinned on this chap's chest, which said, Holy Mother of Mary, forgive me for my sins. I mean, it was, you know, it was a really, really difficult sort of story to cover. It went on for...
It's a form of suicide, isn't it? And, of course, suicide is a mortal sin. Yeah. So you can understand that. But did you ever feel afraid that the IRA might turn on you?
Well, not really, because it was a terribly difficult story to cover. There were atrocities all the time, bombings, people getting killed. But they were quite clever. The paramilitaries on both sides. I don't think they ever injured a journalist in the whole of the time of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, because, you know, an awful lot of what they did was all about, you know, public representation and showing the world what they were all about and that kind of stuff, you know. But anyway, a horrible time and not something we want to dwell on. I just thought we'd finish with a bit of James Bond, because, of course, the new film's come out. There's a chap here, right, his name is Luke Arnold, and he's so obsessed with 007, he's seen the new film 5 times, admits Bond is basically my life, and has a collection of Bond memorabilia worth £100,000. You won't be surprised to know he lives at home with his mum. Do you take the mickey out of a chap like that, or do you say, look, live and let live? If this guy's a Bond fanatic and likes doing that sort of thing, why not?
I won't ridicule him, but obsessions are unhealthy. Mm-hmm. Allowing the life and career of a real life person or a fictitious character to dominate and subsume your own life has got to be a psychological defect. He probably needs treatment, because it's not normal. I get a lot of abuse, especially on Twitter, from these obsessive Queen fans who seem to think that I'm the devil. And are, I mean, I just saw Jeremy Vine has launched an action in the High Court against somebody who's been abusing him on Twitter and YouTube. And some of these people, that some of the stuff they say to me, you know, I think sometimes maybe I should do the same, because really, this is a criminal offence to abuse people. But I think anyone who is so obsessed with something that they will not listen to somebody else's viewpoint or allow for the fact that there are other viewpoints to be heard, that is a very dangerous stance to take.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous for yourself as well if you're someone who thinks like that. So I think obsessions are dangerous.
Yeah.
And you need balance in your life. You need to live your own life as opposed to living through somebody else's.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. This guy is called Luke. He says, how about this? He lives with his mum, obtained a license so he can carry his replica James Bond gun about with him, and even his mobile number and email address end with 007. I tend to agree with you. I think that is a bit of an obsession and probably a bit unhealthy. Right, Ms. Jones, time to go again. I want to thank all the people who've tuned in and listened to this podcast. And Ms. Jones, I hope you have a fruitful and fulfilling few days ahead. And to say to our audience, we'll be back with you again very soon. So I go up to see my dentist, and he x-rays it and all that. He says, yeah, I know what we'll do it. We'll take that filling out and I'll chisel it down. We'll put your crown in. I said, okay, fine. And that was £1,000, okay? So...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah.
£1,000.
It was 998 quid. So I said,
they're having a laugh. They see you coming, these dentists.
Well, look, the reason I'm telling you, I'm just going to tell you a story about another dentist. But anyway, point of my story is... About a week later, it still hadn't settled down. You know, I've had lots of crowns before and implants and all that. And, you know, for about a week, the gum can be bruised and you still feel it. But this was not getting any better. So after about 2 weeks, I rang up the dentist and I said, you know, this hasn't worked. I think I might have been given the wrong crown or something. So I go back and look at it. No. I haven't done anything wrong. I wasn't accusing the dentist of doing anything wrong, but I thought, well, if you paid £1,000, it should be better. He said, I think what's happened here is that the nerves are going to have to come out because...
Oh, good.
Yeah, he said the tooth is so badly damaged. So it's the dreaded root canal thing.
Oh, no. Oh, horrible.
Yeah.
Do you want me to come and hold your hand? He looks like a sex god. And the minute he opens his mouth, it all goes a bit limp, you know?
No, I can see it.
Not for me, thanks. After you.
Oh, dear me. I mean, that's a terrible thing. I thought you were going to say, wow, that must have been a fantastic moment in your illustrious career, Mike. The other one I remember was White Wedding. They're the only words I know, but it was called White Wedding, wasn't it?
That's the one I just told you about, yeah.
What's that called?
White Wedding.
Oh, White Wedding, right, okay, yeah, fine, sorry, yeah, I wasn't listening, okay. Obviously.
Keep up, Mike.
Yeah,